Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. A lot of the themes going through my mind in anticipating this talk was a lot of the themes that Lungpa was touching on this morning. Themes of merit, generosity, selflessness. Also, another theme is the aspect of directing the mind. That seems to be a theme on this retreat. The mind always has to be directed. And so the four foundations of mindfulness, satipatthana, the mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, those are ways of directing the mind, because the mind always is being directed. Whatever we're doing, it's always being directed somehow. And when we're directing the mind towards anapanasati, the director is Dhamma. When we're directing the mind towards greed, hatred, and delusion, the director is the kilesa, the defilements. Ajahn Jeff translates as the effluence, the asava. The Thai forest ajahns use this word kilesa, kilate. So the kilesa can define that. That's greed, hatred, and delusion. That branches out into the whole array of, you know, jealousy, envy, you know, longing, rage, irritation, frustration. These are all the coarser kilesa, the coarser defilements. And then on a more refined level, we have eye-making, mind-making, the underlying tendency to conceit. And we also have the vipassana upakilesa, which is things like when we have an insight and the sense of self grabs onto it, the kilesa is always waiting right there as we have insights and identifying with them and turning them from something wholesome into something unwholesome that we grasp onto. So there's these two directors in the heart. There's the Dhamma and there's the Kilesa. And when we come to practice, then it's trying to bring the Dhamma to the forefront. So the heart, the mind, it's always there, whether we're in retreat or not. And if we've been practicing for a long time, we can see that the Dhamma and the Kilesa are always vying for supremacy. We want the Dhamma to be in the higher position. But the Kilesa, they've reigned over the heart for so long, however many lifetimes, we can't count. And so that's why the practice isn't easy. And the kilesa are also, that's tanha, which is unwholesome desire. Tanha, say, sense desire. And these are things that are in the mind telling us if we get this or get that, then we'll be happy. If we fulfill this or that desire, then we'll be happy. If I fulfill this particular desire, you know, I might not be happy, but if I take it to its ultimate point, then maybe I'll be happy. And it's just, it's endless. So it goes around and around. And that's what takes us around on the wheel of samsara. And it conditions rebirth, conditions you know, this is part and parcel, but with karma, the karma and the kilesa working together, this conditions our rebirth. But not to think of the kilesa in an overly negative way, because this is also the reason we're here. This is the wholesome in many ways is also subsumed by the kilesa. But the Dhamma is what's truly good, and that's what's leading us to liberation and freedom, and that's what's holding us, and that's what's going to bring us to an ending of suffering. So raising up that Dhamma director, kilesa director is not going to be happy, so we have to be careful. But using these reflections, to give importance to the Dhamma director in the heart, the directing of the mind away from the unwholesome and towards the wholesome, towards the bright, away from the dark, towards the light, towards the radiant, towards the peaceful. And greed, hatred, and delusion in all of their various aspects. Those are things which are taking us away from peace and well-being, taking us away from Dhamma. And so with this, you know, this suffering, it's the kilesa have, it's as if they've stomped all over the heart for so long. And it's in the suttas that we've cried enough tears in our past lives since beginningless time. We could more tears than would fill the whole ocean, you know, due to the suffering because of the kilesa. And so let's determine to be finished with it. We can do that. We can be finished with suffering. We've had enough. We've had enough of suffering. So haven't we suffered enough? You know, ask ourselves, have how much more do we want to suffer? So when you come to this meditation retreat, it seems like a small thing. It might seem like, okay, well, if I've got my life, it's kind of like ho-hum, you know, mediocre, I'm this or that age, I'm male or female, I'm this type of person, I'm that type of person, I have a 9-to-5 job, or I work in an office, or I'm kind of got this or that ordinary life. But it's good to reflect that we've got the three precious gems, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and no matter how ordinary our life might be and how ordinary this retreat might feel and how mediocre we might think we are, we've come upon this great good fortune that we have these three precious jewels in our possession. They're the very things that are going to allow the heart to achieve liberation, that hope which the heart has always had, which the mind has always had, in all of our past lives and in this life. You know, the heart has always had that hope. The heart has always wanted to be free from suffering. The mind has always wanted to be free, liberated. We don't know how to do that. And so these three refuges, this Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, that's not ordinary that we have those jewels. We have the Dhamma teaching, which is spread like a precious blanket over our age, over our era. So we have the Buddha, who is historically not that long ago, has walked in the world, and we have the great Savaka disciples, the Arhants, Anagamis, Sakadagamis, Sotapanna, and now we have the great Krupa Ajahn of our present era, Ajahn Man, Ajahn Chah, and then their own disciples, the great Kruba Ajahns who out of compassion are teaching all of us. So we have that. And so that's where the attention can be going on a 10-day retreat like this, giving importance to the fact that it's no small thing that we are now part of the Bharami of the Buddha, the great Savaka disciples, and the Kruba Ajahns, and that Bharami is around us, surrounding us, it's over us, and it's looking after us. So there's the Dhamma and the Kilesa, and the heart is the two different directors. We have the Bharami of the Buddha, the Arhants of the past, and the Kruba Ajahns of the present age, here to protect us. And so there's so much more happening than just me and my meditation technique. There's just so much more happening. It's we're part of a large world. So there are these seven factors of awakening I thought I would talk about today. Seven factors of enlightenment, the Bojangga. And these are sati, mindfulness. It's dhammavichaya, which is investigation of states, investigation of dhammas. It's virya, which is energetic striving or effort. Piti, which is joy, rapture. Pasadi, which is peace, tranquility, serenity. Samadhi, which is usually translated as concentration, but it's also like mental steadiness, you know, equanimity. So that's upekkha. So, and these seven factors of awakening are brought about based on four things. They are brought about based on seclusion, viveka. They are brought about based on dispassion, viraga. They're brought about based on cessation, nirodha, and they're brought about based, and they ripen in relinquishment, patinisaga. That's viveka, viraga, nirodha, patinisaga. All seven are brought about by seclusion, by dispassion, by cessation, and ripening and relinquishment. So before I go into sati, or mindfulness, to just touch a little bit on the samadhi aspect, because a 10-day retreat is very much like a lot of sitting and meditation. And so with the samadhi, I think it's important to be contemplating how are we holding the samadhi? And so is it expanded or is it more contracted? We have to be very careful with this, because if we think of samadhi as not thinking, then it's very easy to try to force the mind into a state of not thinking. But then that can have adverse effects when we're not sitting in meditation. So it might be peaceful or even bright and clear, and there may even be some joy or bliss even. But then once we stop meditating, then problems can arise. Or dukkha might arise even more easily than before. So what's happening there? So this reminds me of 10 years ago in the monastery. One morning I had a really good meditation, a really good sit in the morning time. And it was very bright, not much thinking going on. even blissful, very sensitized and very energized. But then after the meditation, it's down doing morning chores for the before breakfast time in the monastery, and another monk who, I guess in his meditation, he'd been proliferating about faults that I had, and approached me and started launching very, very, very harsh and not really true accusations at me, and like right away, right after the meditation. So I just had this really blissful meditation, really good sit, and then I just exploded. I just started yelling at him, and this is, to this day, this is the only time I've spoken based on anger like that, to that extent. But so what was that meditation then? What was it good for? It wasn't that stable. It was blissful, but it was unstable. So then, of course, that didn't have a good result. But at least I learned that speaking like that doesn't have a good result, and didn't do it again. But so it's like when we meditate, is it meditation which is leading towards stability, or is it a meditation which is unstable? And that's really what we want. So an unstable meditation tends to come from focusing in on a very contracted small point. That's what I found, is that's a very unstable place to be. A stable meditation is very expansive and usually coupled with metta, with the metta kamatan. And there's another word which I'd like to define, kamatan. Kamatana, kama is the action, karma. Tana is like satipatthana, like a foundation. Kamatana is usually translated as like our basis for work. So like metta kamatana, that would be our basis of work in terms of our metta practice. You know, asubha kamatana would be our basis of work according to contemplating the unattractive nature of the body. So meditation coupled with metta kamatana. This is an important to have a very stable foundation. And with that, it can be with any of the steps of anapanasati or with the satipatthana, then that samadhi, it can be a lot more stable when we're holding ourselves with metta, we're meditating out of a sense of goodwill for ourselves, not out of a sense of forcing my unwholesome mind to stay on this point so that it can stop messing up, or, you know, just, it's more of a positive. The Kilesa really like it when we're negative towards ourselves. They really like that. They rejoice in that. But in terms of the Dhamma, we want metta towards ourselves. Kilesa doesn't like that. This is a way that Tanajan Mahabua would talk about the Kilesa and the Dhamma in this way, and he would say, like, somebody asked him once, like, well, shouldn't I be like really angry at the Kilesa? And he said, if you get angry at the Kilesa, they just laugh at you. They really like that. Yeah. So you have to, it's using loving kindness, it's a shift, a paradigm shift. So with mindfulness, sati, this mindfulness factor of awakening, this is the four foundations of mindfulness. Or you could think maybe the fourfold foundation of mindfulness. And mindfulness is something that is always to be cultivated. It's something that in these seven factors of awakening, it's something that it carries us through all of them. And it's mindfulness coupled with clear comprehension, sampajanya. And the mindfulness is also coupled with the samadhi, because it's the samadhi, the sama samadhi, is it's a purification of mindfulness. So with each, say if we take the four jhanas, with each jhana, mindfulness is more and more pure in each one, up to the fourth jhana, where there's this phrase, mindfulness fully purified with equanimity. So it's a fully purified, fully pure mindfulness. This also goes hand in hand with the knowing, with the vijja, knowing, true knowledge. So when we talk about the knowing, or just bare awareness, that's one type of mindfulness. But it's good to be clear that mindfulness or that knowing, that's still conditioned. So it's not an unconditioned mindfulness. Mindfulness is a conditioned state. And at this point, the knowing is conditioned too, because it's affected by clinging. So it's not an unconditioned knowing, which is when we talk about Buddho or Buddha, that's the unconditioned knowing. But this is at first, now the knowing is affected by clinging. It's like consciousness, vijnana, that which experiences, it's affected by clinging. So what we know, we're going to invariably be directing our knowing based on clinging, based on attachment at first. As mindfulness, though, becomes more pure through the meditation and less self-centered, the self, if the meditation is very self-centered, that's a smaller point, that's more unstable. If it's not so self-centered, that's more firm, stable, that's a stronger foundation. So with the mindfulness, it's paying attention more to what's actually happening in our experience rather than perceptions that are built up around ourselves. We don't want to get lost in perceptions. You know, it's mindfulness practice and Dhamma practice in general isn't about really trying to sort through everything and figure everything out. That's more a job of maybe psychology, but it's just knowing of experience, knowing what's happening, and a gradual purification of mindfulness in the present moment. And we also don't have to think. We don't have to think about why am I not liberated? Why am I not to this state? You know, I determined that on this retreat I was going to get first jhana, and why hasn't it happened? And so, we don't have to think like that, because things are going to happen in their own time. Everybody's got their own karma, and everyone's got their own barami and their own proclivities and tendencies. So we can't compare with I've been a monk for 12 years. There might be a layperson here who's more developed, far more developed in meditation than I am. And that's completely normal and fine. We can't compare with each other because everybody's at a different level. But using the Dhamma, we know where we're at. So using mindfulness, we see our experience. We know exactly where we're at. We're working from there. And then based on what our experience is, then we're steering our mental habits towards the wholesome. They can't just change based on having the right thought or based on having the right intention, but they can slowly be curbed and slowly can be reformed, reshifted over time. And so that has to happen with the sati sampajanya in the present moment, knowing what's happening. Is the mind wholesome or unwholesome? Is the mind dark or light? Is the mind contracted, distracted? Is the mind have sadness in it, grief, happiness, pity, rapture? Is it peaceful? Is it not peaceful? Not saying any of it is right or wrong, but fully accepting with metta, that foundation of metta, fully accepting what's happening in the present moment, and then working from there to steer it towards the wholesome. And it's good to fully know what's happening, not to deny what's happening. I've been practicing for 20 years. You know, I can't have a thought of anger, so that's denial. But it's more like, well, no, there's a thought of irritation, there's a thought of anger, that's what's happening. And at the very least, whatever is happening in the mind, if it's unwholesome, if it's the kilesa flaring up, really what the kilesa, what their function is to cause us to identify with what's happening in the mind. It's not that we are it's not that we're defined by what's happening in our mind, but the identification with what's happening in the mind is the problem. So to learn how to not identify with the thoughts, with what's happening in the mind, not identifying with seeing it as impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, not identifying with the thoughts in the mind, that's very freeing. That makes things a lot easier. If we sit down to meditate and all sorts of unwholesome thoughts come up and we don't identify with them, already we're very, very free compared to when we did identify with them. Already that's a huge burden lifted. They're still there, but we're not identifying with it. It's just phenomena. A thought is just like a sight or a sound or any other phenomena. A thought is just, it's something that is passing by. We can't, if I see a tree outside and it's ugly and I want to do something about it, I want to go cut it down, that's like seeing an unwholesome thought and trying to destroy it, trying to make it go away. But we also, if I see a tree that I don't like and I decide just to not interact with it and just walk away, that's how we can relate to unwholesome thinking, and then it's not a burden. But at the same time, we have the metta kamatana, we have our different kamatana to steer the mind in a wholesome direction. So it will change with that sense of not identifying. But it takes mindfulness, it takes the sati bojanga, the factor of awakening, which is mindfulness. That's based on seclusion, based on dispassion, based on cessation, ripening, and relinquishment. Then we have Dhamma Vichaya. This can be taken as just reading the teachings, contemplating the teachings, but also it's contemplating the teachings in terms of our own experience. And so we have, say, for example, the teachings of dependent origination, and how can we apply those to our own experience? So what's happening? Say there's pain in the knees, unpleasant feeling, unpleasant sensation in the body, and then we want it to go away. So, that's vedana, that's unpleasant. And there's tanha, which is aversion. Aversion is arising to that sensation. And then we can know that. We can use different sets of dhammas according to our own experience to see what's actually happening, Dhamma Vichaya. Also, learning to recognize the wholesome and the unwholesome in the mind. Learning about also another very important faculty for Dhamma practice, sangvara, restraint. So the sangvara, the restraint that happens when we have there's unwholesome thinking taking place, but it doesn't come out in speech or bodily action. So that faculty of restraint has risen up in order to put a stop to it right there in the mind. I remember reading a teaching of Ajahn Chah where he praised that as good practice. He's not saying you're not ever going to have, you can't have unwholesome thoughts arise or else you can't be a disciple of mine. You can't ever have unwholesome thoughts arising. And no, it's the more the, how's the restraint, how's that, how are you reacting to the unwholesome thoughts and how are you relating to the mind? Sangvara sila, that's the restraint based on our sila, based on the precepts. These are restraining the body and speech so that even though we might be creating mental karma, the verbal and bodily karma isn't being generated there. So Sangvara Sila is a protection for us. And this comes from Dhamma Vichaya, from contemplating Dhamma in terms of our own experience, seeing what's wholesome and unwholesome. Also, when we think of the Sotapanna, the stream enterer, first stage of awakening, there's three things that are let go of at that point. That's Sakaya Ditti, which is self-view. That's Silapata Paramasa, which is attachment to practices, rites, and rituals as a being able to enlighten us in and of themselves. And that's Vichikicca, which is doubt. And in terms of doubt, that particular doubt, which is let go of at the time of stream entry, is doubt as to what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. That's the particular type of doubt that is let go of. So even though someone who has reached stream entry, has reached the first stage of awakening, they might still fall into unwholesome tendencies of body, speech, and mind, but they have no doubt that it's unwholesome. And they have no doubt as to what they're doing is what they're doing is wholesome. So it's that much easier to recognize the unwholesome and still work to be steering it in another direction. Virya, effort. This is not a physical effort, but like has been taught already, is the mental effort of letting go of the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome, learning how to see things as not self rather than identifying, rather than taking things as self. And there's in the Noble Eightfold Path, you also have Samavirya, right effort, or Samavayama, sorry, that's right effort. This is the effort for abandoning unwholesome states that have arisen, for restraining so that unwholesome states that have not yet arisen don't arise in the future. This is giving rise to wholesome states, finding out what we need to do to develop, to give rise to wholesome states have not yet arisen, for example, the seven factors of awakening, and seeing what we can do to maintain and sustain wholesome states that have arisen and to keep them from declining, because they can decline. The sila can decline, samadhi can decline, even panya, even wisdom can decline, so we have to maintain these states, and this is the effort. Of course, it's coupled with mindfulness. We have to see what's happening. With the effort, too, it's being willing to learn, to try different things, to learn how to learn. Try different things, see what works, what's causing suffering, what's causing an ending to suffering, what makes me happy, what makes others happy, what makes me miserable, what makes others miserable. And it does take effort, though. It takes a real effort and a real persistence, commitment to wakefulness as well. It takes that because really the kilesa are always ready and waiting. The effort slips, they come back in. So sometimes we can cruise, practice is going well, we start to cruise, kilesa creep back in. So we have to be careful. With the Dhamma as a director, we're maintaining the wholesome. We can think of it as like a driver too, like the Dhamma is our driver. So as long as the Dhamma's driving, you know, we're going to get somewhere. But if the Kilesa is driving, then it's going to be a disaster. So I'm thinking of this video game, which the kids love to play. Now it's called Grand Theft Auto. And you can get in a car and you can just do whatever you want. You can crash through shop windows. You can run people over. You can run into the police and they can chase you. You can run over old people. You can just wreak havoc in general. And that's really what it's like when the Kilesa are driving. We want the Dhamma to be driving. We're not going to get anywhere if the Kilesa are driving. The Dhamma is driving. We're actually going to get somewhere. We're going to get to our destination. Piety is a factor of awakening. That's joy, rapture. It's interesting that sukha isn't in there, but I think it kind of in the seven factors of awakening, it's kind of subsumed under piety. So that can be anything from just kind of joy to, you know, unbelievable rapture, tears gushing out during the meditation. Piety is also something which is very important when we think of the first jhana, those factors, vitaka vichara, piti sukha, ekagata. It's very, very important, I think, to not leave out piety and sukha, because I remember having experiences. I was in Anagarika, and I had this, what I thought was a really deep meditation. Mind was absorbed into something. It was blank, but it was definitely absorbed. But there was no piti or sukha. There was no joy. And yeah, it was just kind of spaced out. And I remember, kind of full of pride going to Lungpa and asking, like, is that jhana? And he said, no, it's just kind of type of concentration. So there's many types of concentration. Jhana is what we refer to as sama samadhi, right concentration. And so I think that's a very important hallmark, is piti, rapture, joy. And then that kind of bleeds into sukha, which is, I like to think of piti more as something that's happening in the meditation, whereas sukha is something that happens in the meditation but also carries over into our daily life. It's a very deep well-being, a very deep contentment. The mind is gladdened. The mind is happy. So all this effort we put into meditation, the mind is happy. It takes a lot of effort to be happy, to be glad. It's like years of mindfulness and practice and meditation. How happy is the mind? Is it gladdened? Is it happy yet? And if not, why is that? So piety is a factor of awakening. It's not that. I remember also years ago going to a local community college in Ukiah with Lungpa, and I was just giving a talk at the college in the evening time, and there was a talk and the meditation and then question and answer, and someone asked a question. Or they kind of had a view of what Nibbana was, and it was kind of like, well, how can we as ordinary people attain Nibbana if the way to do it is just you have to become so sad and miserable that something just gives and then you attain Nibbana? No, that's definitely not how it works. No, it's graduated levels of happiness, contentment, and well-being. It's a graduated training. It's not that we bind ourselves with restraint and precepts and just general misery to the point where something breaks and we get enlightened somehow. Or we read like the biography of Ajahn Mun and he passed out three times and he was so ardent in his meditation. But we really have to take that in. You know, that's why it's really, really glad I went to Thailand for 5 years, because then you meet monks who are practicing like that, and it's not what it's not what you think. There's a lot of joy arising when someone is meditating to the point of like Ajahn Mun was in his practice. Piety is unbelievable that he was experiencing at that time, and the zeal that he was feeling, and that sense of urgency, and the ardent effort that he was putting into his practice, the bojango were becoming full, and so we have to take that into the context. Ajahn Mun wasn't meditating till he passed out three times, just out of like a wish to annihilate himself or out of misery. It's actually done with metta, but when one reaches that level of practice, the zeal and the piety is so strong that we have to take it in that context. And the virya, when the virya truly awakens to that level, where of the great Krupa Ajahns of the past, practicing, say, even without sleeping, it's not done in a way of forcing so much as a way of, it's at, the faith is so strong that they can't stop it. They can't not practice that way. So that's piety as a factor of awakening. Then we have samadhi, the meditation. Concentration is probably actually a really bad word for that, for samadhi, because in Thai, Ajahn Buddhadasa translates it as kwam tang jai man, which is like the heart is stable and firm and upright, and it's standing firm. And so with samadhi, it's something which is, it's a stability, it's giving a stability to our life. It's not just like, it's not just sitting in meditation or sitting in samadhi. It's something which we can have whether we're sitting or walking meditation, or it can be an underlying factor of our life. It can become stronger and stronger. It can bleed into every area of our life. Everything we do can be done with samadhi. It's like the walking meditation. The example was brought up of Thanh Ajahn Khao practicing walking meditation, at least 9 hours a day, practicing walking meditation. And the walking meditation is really good for samadhi. The Buddha spoke in praise of walking meditation, in that any samadhi one achieves or attains during walking meditation will last for a long time. And so it's to be given importance to. And the Buddha himself, after his enlightenment, continued to practice walking meditation for the rest of his life. He had a period every day where he'd be doing walking meditation out in the open or at the foot of a tree or outside of his kuti. So even for the arhants, even for those who are fully enlightened, walking meditation and sitting meditation, cultivation of the satipatthana, this creates a pleasant abiding here and now. Walking meditation also it's traditionally practiced in Thailand, in that one will walk meditation for a period of time and then sit afterwards. This can be a great foundation for the sitting meditation. One is awake. If there's sloth and torpor, some sort of drowsiness during the sitting meditation, then using the walking meditation, one can also be either slow or a bit more vigorous during the walking meditation. Ajahn Chah himself would walk meditation quite fast because he said that would help his mind to become peaceful. And so one has to gauge for oneself, one has to know oneself. What is the walking meditation? What speed is good for me? So for myself, like I have a lot of energy in the body, so I usually start walking meditation fast, and then I'll slow down as the energy calms down a bit. And I find that a really good way to dissipate maybe excess energy or extra energy before coming to the sitting meditation. So with samadhi, it's sitting meditation and walking meditation. These two formal practices can be used for the cultivation of that underlying samadhi in daily life. But yeah, I especially love the walking meditation just because it's something where you can do the walking meditation and whatever meditation object we have, there may be a meditation object or some sort of contemplation. You can also use mindfulness of breathing during the walking meditation. But then say walking up the hill at Abhayagiri, that's also a walking meditation. Or even working, doing duties. Lungpar Liam, he's a great example of this. We see him, he's working all the time, building things, going to different monasteries, overseeing building projects, and we're asking him about it, and he's saying, well, it's kind of like walking meditation. And I'm saying, well, how is that? And he said, well, if when you're building all these things, if you think I'm working, you're already suffering. So you just, he just said, yeah, I just don't identify, you know, I just move the body. I'm just moving the body around. And that's not easy to do. That's the ultimate level, but that's what's possible. That's what's possible with that samadhi, which underlies our daily life. Then we have equanimity. It's a factor of awakening. So, I'm the owner of my kama, heir to my kama, born of my kama, related to my kama, abide supported by my kama, whatever kama I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir, and that's true for others as well. Others are owners of their kama, heir to their kama, and so on. And that's traditionally the cultivation of equanimity, is the reflection on kama. And so in the, in the world, there's so much suffering. And all of this suffering inside of ourselves and outside, on a subtle level, our own dukkha, on a more world scale, we have war, killing, the horrors of all the horrors that are happening in the world and have happened in the past. These are all brought about from just huge misunderstandings between people, and everything, you know, genocide, brought about just huge misunderstandings, religious conflict, religious wars. Just, it's all just a big, grossly unfortunate misunderstanding. And with equanimity, This is understanding. This comes from an understanding of kama, this equanimity. And it allows us to be able to step back, not in an indifferent way, but allows us to cultivate a serenity based on our own unwholesome actions we may have done, or if we've done something wholesome and we're reaping the fruits of that, also reflecting that was a cause that was planted, and I can continue to plant more wholesome causes. If someone else is stuck in suffering, there's only so much we can do. The best we can do is give the Dhamma teachings, give support. But also they have their kama. They have their kama as well. If someone is achieving success in their practice, we have mudita for that, sympathetic joy. But also they place the causes for that. The Buddha reaching enlightenment, he planted the causes for that. The Savaka disciples, they all planted the causes. They all planted the causes. Spiritual perfections, their barami was fully ripe, and all of the great Krupa Ajans, they all did the work, they all planted the causes. And these were all people too. So there's causes and there's results. And when we see that, we can step back from that. And rather than bemoaning the results, that are happening in the present, we use equanimity in order to come back to a place of steadiness and then know how to avoid planting unwholesome causes and planting wholesome causes in the present. For the sake of the future, that's the best we can do. And these seven factors of awakening are based on seclusion, based on viveka. So a 10-day retreat, that's viveka, that's seclusion. We're not talking very much, so that's chitta viveka, because it's chitta viveka because we don't have to be anybody, we don't have to go out, we don't have to interact. It's based on dispassion, so we're not involved in passion during this retreat. We have the precepts, we're using the Sangvara Sila for this period of time. It's based on Nirodha, it's based on cessation, allowing things to drop away. Things are ceasing, things are dropping away. And ripening in relinquishment, ripening in letting go. But also just reiterating the importance of coming back to metta kamatana and using that as a foundation for the meditation. And that's a good wishing. It's a good wishing for oneself, a good wishing for others. If we see others in the hallway, we don't have to interact, but we can wish each other well. It's not just a rote saying, may you be well, but it's a heartfelt wish. You know, may you be well. May you be free of sorrow. May you be free of sadness. May you achieve success in your practice. Yeah, may these seven factors of awakening come to fulfillment in you during this 10-day retreat, but also beyond that time. May they become something which holds and protects you in your life, in addition to the Bharami of the Krupa Ajahns and the Buddha, and the Triple Gem. So I'll leave that for today.